what we are missing to really see this kind of very promising data implementing in clinical practice is the qualification of microbiome-based biomarkers. Because when you have this kind of qualified-based biomarkers, it's biomarkers that are really recognized by the medical community and implemented in clinical practice, meaning that you can really analyze in the future. Maybe you can really analyze the gut microbiota as you analyze, I don't know, blood sugar in the patient and predict based on this signature if the patient will respond or not. And with this kind of biomarker, you can also avoid to administer to patients maybe drugs that will have side effects and not useful for the patient. So you can really move towards what we call personalized medicine.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today we have two guests on the podcast, and we're delighted that we're joined by Céline Drouard and Camille Bello from Pharmabiotics Research Institute. So I believe, Camille, you're going to tell us what the PRI, or Pharmabiotics Research Institute, is. So could you do that, please?
Yes, thank you, Colin. So just to set the stage, the Pharmabiotic Research Institute, or PRI, is Europe's go-to institution when it comes to microbiome regulatory science. And what that really means is helping figure out how we safely and effectively bring microbiome-based products like probiotics or gut-targeted therapies or even microbiome-based diagnostics to market. We have been around for about a decade as a nonprofit, and our goal is to make sure that innovation in the microbiome space doesn't get blocked by outdated or unclear regulations. Take something like immunotherapy based on gut bacteria. Well, our work is to help our partners navigate how to prove it safe and what rules apply to make it a reality in the European market.
Let's talk about the example of a patient who's just been diagnosed with cancer, and they're going to be getting immune checkpoint inhibitors. And they've heard from others that there's something about the gut microbiome that might potentially help understand if they're going to have a successful response to the treatment. What is your mission at PRI relevant to that patient's questions about, can they trust what somebody might tell them about the gut microbiome might be useful? And what are the obligations that we have to that person to make sure that they are able to trust anybody that's trying to tell them that they could use the gut microbiome to predict whether they're going to have a response to treatment?
Yes, that's a key question. So currently it's still very difficult to clearly answer this question because we are still in a very new field. So we have more and more data showing that the gut microbiota composition can influence the response to immune checkpoint inhibitors, but it's still at a clinical research stage. So currently there is no microbiome-based biomarker. So we still don't see the use of a particular microbial signature for, like in this case, predict the response to immune checkpoint inhibitors. So for this patient, basically, they have currently only one option is to enter in a clinical study to in which you can really analyze the influence of the gut microbiota composition in the response to immune checkpoint inhibitors. You have also ongoing clinical studies where administration of particular bacteria are also analyzed to see if they can really modify the gut microbiota composition and make a non-responding patient to a responding patient, but it's still under clinical research stage. And what we are missing to really see this kind of very promising data implementing in clinical practice is the qualification of microbiome-based biomarkers. Because when you have this kind of qualified-based biomarkers, it's biomarkers that are really recognized by the medical community and implemented in clinical practice, meaning that that you can really analyze in the future. Maybe you can really analyze the gut microbiota as you analyze, I don't know, blood sugar in the patient and predict based on this signature if the patient will respond or not. And with this kind of biomarker, you can also avoid to administer to patient maybe drugs that will have side effects and not useful for the patient. So you can really move towards what we call personalized medicine.
Celine, can I ask, we're in an odd situation, I think, with the microbiome, that you're absolutely correct. We'd love to develop microbiome biomarkers to predict, to stratify patients for a particular treatments or to predict outcomes, or even maybe to manipulate the microbiome in order to guarantee a better outcome. And at the same time, the same clinicians that we're trying to convince, you know, the microbiome is important to health, are prescribing antibiotics every day and causing massive shifts in microbiome. Dietitians are proposing dietary shifts that influence the microbiome. And none of those, I presume, would want biomarkers, because we'd never prescribe an antibiotic if it caused liver damage or kidney damage. But we do prescribe antibiotics that cause microbiome damage, if that's even a good term. How do you think we're going to get out of this area where the microbiome should be very important to some clinicians and irrelevant almost to others?
That's a very difficult question, because we need antibiotics in some cases. We need antibiotics to save life. But on the other side, we also need to, preserve the microbiome. We are all aware of the importance of the diversity of the microbiome. And we know that when we, for example, receive antibiotics, we can have like damage in the microbiome during years after the administration of the antibiotic. So I think the answer, and it's also linked to the emergence of more and more antibiotic resistance. We have to safely use the antibiotics when it's really needed. The same for very restrictive dietary habits. We have to use that in, I would say, the very last resort, when we tried everything else and when we need this kind of very important treatment. But at the other side, yes, we have to be aware. And I think it's also where we have a role as scientists to educate also the medical doctors and all the public health authorities about the importance of the microbiome, why it is so important. And also, I'm aware of some program to develop new antibiotics, mainly to find a solution regarding antibiotic resistance. But also in this kind of program, they push to develop antibiotics that are, I would say, microbiome friendly, so that preserve the microbiome as much as we can, because of course I think it's part of the game. We will have always deleterious effect on the microbiome, but you can really not develop narrow antibiotics to really fight against the bacteria that you want to eliminate and to preserve the microbiome.
Celine, I'm going to ask you a question that ultimately comes down to, what is good regulatory science and good regulation look like? But the way I'm going to frame it is in the context of, as scientists, we have that challenge of what we want to tell our loved one about what they can trust now, what's safe and efficacious, and we have high confidence in it now, versus where we have hopes that in the future we'll be able to develop those good products. So we never want to stifle innovation, but we also don't want to oversell things that we still need to get evidence on. So in that context, can you talk to us about what good regulatory science and what a good regulatory environment will look like for the scientist and for the consumers?
Of course. So one key point to keep in mind, because we very often complain about regulation, but regulation are needed to avoid, as you mentioned, overpromising products, also to avoid unsafe product release on the market. And also one key point to keep in mind is that regulation will always come after innovation, because regulators will start to work on new regulatory framework only when they are seeing new products or new innovation coming to their office. So it's why, and it's always the case, that regulation arrive after innovation. So for the first product they have always, I would say, passed through very difficult moments with regulatory authorities because they are so new that the regulation is not fit for them. So, yes, it's why regulatory science is so important, because the objective of regulatory science is to evolve regulatory frameworks based on innovation and based on scientific data. Regulatory science is also supporting the development of new analytical methods, models to support the regulatory development and regulatory approval of new innovations.
And Celine, I don't want to take us off topic, but you said, and I agree with you completely, that regulation is absolutely essential to protect the consumer and also to reward the people who do the good science and develop the good products. But doesn't kind of public feeling sometimes almost come into it? I mean, again, not to go too far off topic, but GMOs are still essentially banned in Europe, even though I'm not aware of any real scientific evidence that they're bad for consumers. But the sense I get is the regulatory authorities feel like the consumers just don't want it, and so they stay away from that area. Is that a risk? Do regulators sometimes feel like they have to respond to the political or consumer attitudes?
That's a key question. I'm not able to comment on GMO because I'm not a specialist at all of this kind of question. But that's true that GMO is, I would say, a difficult topic in Europe. But now we have more and more GMOs develop, and even bacterial strain, genetically modified, develop to produce like enzymes, anti-inflammatory components, and so on. So they are under development, but with a very strict approach, especially also an environmental risk approach, because it's very important to be sure that this strain is not released in the environment and can really multiply in the environment. But indeed, regulatory authorities can be influenced by also political aspects and lobbying also activities. So yes, they have to deal with multiple factors. And indeed, in Europe, maybe consumers and citizens are not really open to GMOs, but I think it's also because of some myths that can exist about GMOs and so on. So yes, it's also our role, I think, as scientists to be sure that the facts are there and just also to reassure the citizens and the regulatory authorities about facts. Like as you mentioned, with GMOs, we can really control the GMO and so on. So the risk can be mitigated. So it's very important to share scientifically based information.
Where do we need to go, Celine, in terms of developing and validating biomarkers that satisfy other scientists and the public and government regulators that these are worthwhile biomarkers for the microbiome to predict response to treatment or health or, you know, prognosis, things like that?
I think biomarkers are really expected from the different stakeholders. So they are expected from the product developer's point of view, but they are expected also from the medical doctor's point of view, and of course, from the citizen and regulatory authorities. Because when you have biomarkers, everything is, I would say, easier, because you know exactly what to measure to predict, for example, a response to treatment or to also predict a risk to develop a disease. But the development of biomarkers is a very long process. The first step is, of course, the discovery of biomarkers. And in the context of microbiome, we have now a lot of biomarkers in discovery. So the scientists identified a lot of microbiome signature in different contexts or diseases in which microbiome is different. But then we have still at this stage, because we have different hurdles and challenges in validating the microbiome-based biomarkers. And in the Delphi survey that we conducted and published, we identify several of these challenges. A key one is the current lack of validation of analytical methods used to analyze the microbiome, because we use very complex analytical methods, mostly currently based on the genomic analysis of the microbiome. So what we call the metagenomics is very complex. I think we are also in the, even for the analytical methods, we are still in its infancy phase. So we are still learning, developing new analytical pipelines, database, and so on. So it's still evolving quite quickly. It's a major hurdle for that. And then we have
Let's make that concrete. You mean that if you go from one lab to another, people do things differently because there's a lot of decisions to make, and what seems like a good decision for one lab may not work as well for another lab. So you mean standardizing those pipelines.
And if you repeat, if you send the same samples to two different labs, you can obtain different results. And that's really an issue. In an absolute way, you can obtain different results, because if we think to, I would say, more classical biomarkers, if you send the same blood samples to two labs, you can obtain different absolute results. But at the end, the diagnostic or the prediction of the treatment should be the same. So, for example, if you send a blood sample, if you are diabetic, you are diabetic in both labs. But with the microbiome, it's still not the case, because we are still learning, developing the techniques. But if we want to move really, like I would say, if we want to make the step toward clinical implementation, we have to work on this kind of validation, even if we are continuing to develop new and to improve the analytical methods. Because I think it's something also very important to understand that both can really coexist. It's not because you validate and you qualify the techniques that you cannot improve the techniques. It's still feasible. And so we have to move with the two approach in parallel to allow the clinical implementation of microbiome-based biomarkers.
Do you think, Celine, that the biomarkers have to directly relate to health, or can they be proxies like blood pressure or cholesterol levels or something? Because if I'm a customer or a consumer or a patient, I don't really care what happens to my biomarkers when I take an intervention. I care about what happens to my health outcome. You know, do I feel better? Am I cured, treated, or have I prevented a disease? So why are biomarkers important? Why don't we just do interventions, measure health outcomes, and base every decision on that?
Biomarkers are important because it will also help to design a better intervention. Because biomarkers is really important for in clinical practice. Even if it's a proxy, we have to really demonstrate a direct link between that proxy and a health outcome or disease progression or response to a treatment. With the microbiome, we are still also in this phase that we are not really sure if the modulation of the microbiome is the cause or the consequence of the disease, the same for response to treatment. But we are also moving in the right direction, because now we have researchers that can really develop a signature that predict, for example, immune checkpoint inhibitors. That I think it's a very good example, because they are really moving fast in this field, because it's also a clear unmet medical need. Cancer patients are really waiting to receive the good treatment, and to anticipate the response is key. So yeah, we have to develop biomarkers to also develop intervention, because we know what to change to have a direct effect on health.
Celine, I think you're right to say that we first have to standardize the laboratory results, but then we have to do what Colin shows, which is you have to link the biomarker to the health outcome that's relevant for the clinicians and the patients. And that requires another level of validation that's very expensive. Once it's done, then we can be confident that that biomarker can be used as an inexpensive or faster way to get at a tough question, which is how healthy is the patient or how likely are they to respond. But the overall process for developing a biomarker is extremely expensive. And I applaud the work that you've been doing at PRI to try to understand and improve the process for us getting there. Do you have any further thoughts on where you see the community of microbiome of scientists and sponsors of the research to developing microbiome biomarkers?
So to qualify microbiome-based biomarkers or any kind of biomarker, we need to validate the results that we obtain in the discovery phase. We need to validate and to replicate the results that we obtain in very large clinical studies. So usually international clinical studies. So you perform the clinical studies in several countries to be sure that the results that you obtain are really applicable to different kind of population with different genetic backgrounds. In our case, microbiome composition. nutrition, dietary habits, and so on, because we know that, and it's also the complexity of microbiome studies, we know that there are so many confounding factors that can really affect the microbiome that it's very important to have very large core studies. And these kind of studies are, of course, very expensive. So I think the future and the best way to fund this kind of large studies is to have collaboration, public-private funding, because it's almost impossible for a company to fund this kind of study. It's also impossible for an academic lab to fund this kind of study. So it's really both public and private entities that can really work together to fund this kind of studies. But then also for me, one key point, because of the price of this kind of study, is to be sure about the design of the study, the power of the study, because we can see that sometimes microbiome studies are underpowered, and so at the end, the results are inconclusive, and be sure that we use validated analytical methods to be fully confident in the result that we will obtain, and also to be able in the future to make also meta-analysis, because it's also something that we are missing in the microbiome field, is the possibility to make meta-analysis, because we have so much confounding factors, different analytical pipeline and so on, that still meta-analysis are very, I would say, rare in the microbiome field. And so, yeah, everything put together, I think we can really move forward to the development of this kind of biomarkers.
I think you're absolutely right about the difficulty and the cost of doing it. But of course, the rewards are enormous if we can develop these biomarkers, because it's not limited to the pharmaceutical giants or anyone to take advantage of those biomarkers. Food industry, small biotech, startups, they can all, once we have validated biomarkers, then they're available to everybody, including customers and patients, even to test for themselves.
But that's also the difficulty with biomarker. We lack a clear incentive, because biomarkers are public. So a company can develop a biomarker, but at the end, the biomarker will be publicly available. And so I would say the main benefit for developing biomarker is really public health, because you develop something that is a predictor of a risk or a disease or a response treatment. So it's biomarker is key for public health.
Camille, what can you tell our listeners about how to follow PRI and what steps you guys are taking to advance the mission of improving the quality of the science?
Well, I think the most impactful thing you can do right now is to follow our communications on LinkedIn, and then subscribe to our communications in our website. But then more specifically coming up, we have our yearly conference that will be held this year in Brussels on July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd.
We will have a dedicated session about microbiome-based biomarkers, microbiome testing and diagnostic, because in parallel to microbiome-based biomarker, we have also the question of microbiome testing, and to be sure that microbiome testing is aligned with the expectation from the medical doctors. So we have a full session on that topic, and we hope to have high-level speakers also working on the development of microbiome-based biomarkers for immune checkpoint inhibitors.
Sounds like a really exciting conference. And thank you both for joining us today. We really appreciate you giving us our time.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.